After being ignored to some extent, Arizona turned into a popular spot for presidential candidates on both sides of the aisle over the past week or so. And now we have the results of the state's presidential preference election. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, we'll review the results. We'll also explore voter behavior with Mike O'Neill, who studied it for years. Why do candidates gain momentum? Do voters like to support a winner, or is it something deeper than that? Also, America's national parks have been hit hard recently by allegations of misconduct and sexual harassment. Some female park employees at the Grand Canyon were subjected to it. I'll talk with journalist Catherine Joyce about her story looking into the abuses. Plus, the desert is the setting and the star of a new mystery by James Anderson. We'll find out why it's so haunting in his novel, The Never Open Desert Diner. And whether it's with Pretty Woman or Only the Lonely, singer Roy Orbison put off a vibe of someone who'd known tough times. A new documentary explores that more deeply, and we'll talk about it. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first. It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, we'll talk about voter behavior. Why do candidates gain momentum? Do voters like to support a winner? Or is it something deeper than that? Also, America's national parks have been hit hard recently by allegations of misconduct and sexual harassment. Some female park employees at the Grand Canyon were subjected to it. I'll talk with journalist Catherine Joyce about her story, looking into her reporting on the abuses. We start today's program with a look at yesterday's presidential preference election in Arizona. Lines at polling places were incredibly long, with voters still in line for hours after polls officially closed at 7 p.m. There was frustration expressed by many, but some people were pleased that Arizonans were so motivated to vote. On the Republican side, Donald Trump was the winner. Hillary Clinton won on the Democratic side. This morning, Governor Doug Ducey issued a statement saying the primary should be simplified in part by allowing independents to vote in it. Chuck Coughlin is president of the consulting firm High Ground and has been a leader of a new push for open primaries in Arizona. And he joins me now. Chuck, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. So what does Governor Ducey's statement say to you? Should we read something broader into that, the idea that independents can vote in primaries? Or is this just sort of because this happened yesterday, it looked bad for Arizona, and he's issuing a statement?
Yeah, I think it was mostly press coverage, and a defensive maneuver on his part. I think the acknowledgement by the Secretary of State and the legislature was this would probably be the last presidential preference primary conducted in this manner. That's been the debate down at the legislature because, as you mentioned, of the provisions which don't permit independents to vote in the election. They have to actually re-register 30 days prior to the election or 30 days prior to early voting in order to cast a ballot. And so, you know, they're taxpayers, they pay taxpayer money, and they're treated unequally. And I don't think it would withstand a court test in the future, and they know that.
So is this something, we know there have been some issues related to the push for the ballot initiative that you're involved in, but is this something that do you think can get voters more revved up, this idea that independents have this huge percentage now of registration in Arizona, and though what happened last night cannot be solely or perhaps even partly attributed to independents, there was something there. Do you think this can renew momentum?
Oh, I believe that. I you see that around the country with all of these presidential primaries and what you know, the limited amounts of participation. It's a very small percentage in most of these states that are participating in choosing the leader of or who will be the nominee from those parties. And mostly independent voters routinely are disenfranchised or dissuaded from participating in one form or another throughout all of those cycles. Very few states, like New Hampshire, you can re-register the day of the election and then re-register on your way out. But it's a part of your identity if you're an independent voter to say, I'm not a member of that party, yet you're compelling me to participate in a taxpayer-funded election by saying I am a member of that party, and you're not. And so it's something that I've come to understand as a consultant over time. I used to think fairly routinely that independent voters were just lazy. They just didn't participate. And that's wrong. It's in what our research shows that people do want to participate. It's just it's about identity politics. You're forcing somebody to identify with an institution that they don't believe in while their taxpayer monies are going to support the very the election that they're not being allowed to participate in equally. So I think it does fuel voter discontent around the country. I think it's part of what is fueling a lot of what's going on. I think dark money disclosure is part of that. That's fueling you know, a lack of trust in the system that you see routinely discussed now in all national media and Arizona media, is to say, when we're on this trend line of fewer and fewer people trusting the government and trusting various levels of government. And that's reflected in these types of policies where you disenfranchise portions of the electorate from participating, or you not only disenfranchise, but you may create additional hurdles, like a former poll tax, to be able to participate. So it is part of it. It's a mosaic, like most things are in elections. It's not any one thing, but this is certainly part of it. And you saw some of that yesterday. I was told that there was, you know, 22,000 ballots cast yesterday, provisionally. Mm. Those were independent voters who showed up at the poll and said, sorry, you can't participate. I haven't confirmed with Helen and the office down there exactly how many people turned up. I know in the last cycle there were over 50,000 ballots that were turned in that were never counted because they're not a member of the party.
Right.
And so that, you know, that's just, I think it rubs people generally, regardless of political persuasion, the wrong way. And our research that we did with Paul Johnson and the Open Primaries group and independent voting in particular showed that broad cross sections of the electorate, both Democrat, Republican, all agree that voters all should be treated equally, and that there shouldn't be additional hurdles to participating in an election.
Yeah, but Chuck, let me jump in just for a second, though, because I feel like the system seems so disjointed, even more so now, and it almost feels like it'll continue to be that way, only because, and there have been many studies on this too, that independents cannot be seen as moderates. Some of them are, in fact, many of them are just not thrilled with the Republican Party or the Democratic Party. So it's hard to make those people into one mass group that wants to work together to change.
Right, which means if you want the system to work, I mean, America was born on the idea of a meritocracy. You know, it was like you got to rise to the level of your talent, vote for the best man or woman. And that's really where we need to focus the reform effort, is not around parties, because parties are always going to exist, but they're private institutions, they're private businesses, and so, or private entities. And so those entities should fund their own elections unless they have open participation for everybody. And that I think is the direction of the reform movement going around the country. And I think that's where you'll end up seeing it, but it's very difficult to do. As we observed with our effort, when you have an additional layer, additional hurdle now to reform the system, because people are very vested in that system, and people will spend an enormous amount of money defeating these types of efforts to create broader participation. And the only way to do it, in my view, is going to the ballot in progressive states like Arizona and places that, you know, became states around the turn of the century, the 1900s, when populism was a very strong tool, and the ability to go to the ballot is ensconced in constitutions. We fortunately have that here in Arizona. And, you know, we're still hoping that there's an opportunity to do that, but it looks diminished now, at least in this cycle. But as Paul Johnson said in our initial press conference on this type of stuff, if not now, it will happen someday. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you know, the very institutions that we're relying on to govern ourselves, I think, fail, because they will fail to represent the broad section or cross section of the American electorate.
Chuck Coughlin is president of the consulting firm High Ground. As we mentioned, he's been a leader of a new push for open primaries in Arizona. Chuck, thanks for the time.
Thanks for your time.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. One group of voters expected to have a huge impact on Arizona and other Southwest states as we move toward the fall is Latinos. With me to talk about that is Antonio Gonzalez of the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project. Antonio, good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm good. Do you have any idea yet about how active Latino voters have been in the primaries, the caucuses so far during this cycle? I know Arizona was just yesterday, but I'm thinking in terms of maybe Nevada and Texas.
The Latino vote We've had now 25 primaries and primary elections and caucuses in states, and maybe 27 and three territories, three or four territories. So we've got a good sample size now. Latinos were relevant in, I would say, 11 of those elections within states with at least 100,000 Latino registered voters. And the report is that the Latino vote, I can't say that it's, you have more Latinos voting, but I can say that the Latino vote is a bigger share of the votes cast than it has been in the past. And those are two different things. There's less Democrats voting, and most Latinos are Democrats, but of those Democrats that are voting compared to 2008, the last open election, a bigger share of them are Latinos. So the weight of the Latino vote is greater than it has been at any time in the past in the Democratic primary. The same is not true in the Republican primary, because you've got massive Republican turnout, and that in a way dilutes the share of the Republican vote that is Latino. And Latinos have trended away from Democrats in this era for a variety of reasons. Nevada, Latino vote was 19%. That's a historic high. Texas, it was 28. That's about normal. Arizona was 20. In the Democratic side, the Republican number escapes me. I think it was 10. Those are good numbers. In places like Michigan, North Carolina, Georgia, the trend was up. And in Illinois, the trend was, they were about 9%, which is about par. So the Latino vote is, it is in a growth moment. I can't tell you about Colorado because there was no exit poll. Anecdotally, we think it was pretty good. Massachusetts, same thing. Latino numbers weren't reported. And Arizona was screwy. So Arizona was supposed to be the highest, you know, as high as Texas. Right, because you know the Arizona Latino vote has caught the Texas Latino vote, and people may not know what that means, but the standards in Latino politics are Texas and California, each with about a quarter of the vote being Latinos in both states. Arizona didn't used to be that big, but because of the wonderful things that are going on in your state, Latino vote has grown dramatically in the last 10 years from about 14% of the voters to now it's 25% of the voters, a bigger share than in Texas or California by a little bit. But it's, people don't realize Arizona is now a big Latino vote player across the country.
Why?
Bigger portion than in Florida, bigger portion than New York.
I think those of us in Arizona.
But it was all goofed up yesterday. And the Latino vote, in fact, I believe the Latino vote was suppressed yesterday. And there may be court actions coming. You've read the reports. They're starting to filter out massive lines.
Oh, yes.
People denied provisional ballots. Independents that have become Democrats in the last 30 days were denied provisional ballots, according to massive numbers of reports. The Sanders campaign is throwing a hissy fit, perhaps rightfully so. You know, campaigns do polls, and these polls, you always take them with a grain of salt because you say, well, it's a campaign. They're going to favor their candidate by 5 points. The Sanders campaign had it a favor of 1 going into the election. They lost by 18 at the latest count. That is an unreasonable margin of error. The Sanders campaign is a competent campaign, and they have reason to be concerned. And I wouldn't be surprised if they challenged and disputed in court these elections results. They're claiming to have been suppressed hundreds of thousands of voters. And guess what? Mostly those voters are Latinos.
Well, we'll be keeping a very close eye on that in Arizona. Antonio, that's all the time we have, but thanks very much for the time. It's Antonio Gonzalez of the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project. And still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk about voting behavior. And later this hour, we'll hear about sexual harassment at the Grand Canyon. Stay with us.
KJZZ is supported by AJ's Fine Foods, offering chef-prepared dinners, specialty meats, fine wines, and desserts for spring celebrations. 10 Valley locations can be found at AJsFineFoods.com.
This is Here and Now on KJZZ. Be with us at 1 for NewsHour from the BBC. Well, here's what's going on in Valley traffic at this hour. I-10 westbound, a collision is blocking two lanes at 32nd Street. That's causing some slowing through there. On the surface streets in Scottsdale, the eastbound lanes of Via Linda are closed at 92nd Street. That's due to a tree in the road after a collision there. Plenty of sunshine across the state at this hour. It's 41 degrees in Flagstaff, 48 in Prescott, 64 in Tucson, and 72 in Yuma. Our transborder unit reporters are exploring the hidden stories beyond our borders. This month, you've been hearing our series on Colombia and its connections to Arizona. Now, join us for a town hall meeting to find out how the transborder unit works. Be part of the conversation. Join us on Thursday. Find out more at transborder.kjzz.org. It's mostly sunny and 67 degrees in Phoenix at 11:22.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Yesterday's long lines and passionate turnout for Arizona's presidential preference election surprised many observers, but voters surprising journalists and pollsters is really nothing new. So why do voters behave like they do, especially during this current presidential election cycle? With me to talk about that is political analyst and longtime pollster Mike O'Neill of O'Neill Associates. Mike, good morning.
Good morning.
So there were several things I want to get to, but first of all, because of last night, let's talk about the long lines of people at polling stations throughout the valley waiting to cast their votes. What struck me as especially interesting was this idea that even after Donald Trump was called the winner on the Republican side, Hillary Clinton on the Democratic side, people still were staying hours after to make sure their votes were counted. What do you make of that?
I make of that the fact that we here in Arizona for almost a year now have been spectators to this process. And for the last 7 days, we've been participants, and all of a sudden there's a sense that now it's our turn to express ourselves, and I think that was reflected in the long lines.
And so do you think the long lines are going to have something, a long-term effect, let's say? People are going to think about those visuals, they're going to think about perhaps the frustration they had, or will there be more of a positive spin on it?
I think the first thing that is going to happen is there's going to be some recriminations with the people who run the elections, and there's going to be some explaining required, because part of the issue was that they cut the number of polling places from 200 to 60. Obviously, that contributed. They, you know, if you want to smell conspiracy, there's a conspiracy. On the other hand, you can just say, you know, it just may have been a miscalculation, but certainly one way or the other, it was a mess.
Mike, are voters driven by other voters in some sense? Because one of the things that Helen Purcell, the Maricopa County Recorder, has said is that we expected a lot more mail-in ballots. We didn't expect that, and that's why they cut the polling stations, of course. Is there something about, especially when you talk about Arizona feeling ignored and whatnot, being sort of a flyover state, does that passion to want to be there with fellow Americans voting, does that still carry weight?
I think that probably is what keeps you in line. Once you get there, there's kind of a collective thing. I saw very little signs of people leaving the line, and I think then you have a collective mentality. There's other explanations for last-minute voting. For one thing, on the Republican side, the situation was very much in flux. There may have been a lot of people who wanted to wait to make a decision. There's certainly been intensity. The candidates who showed up in the, you know, all of the candidates except John Kasich showed up in Arizona over the last 7 days, and there was a palpable sense of excitement about this election.
Are you surprised there wasn't more of an anti-Trump push based on what happened? There's been backlash about some of the things he said, even the situation that happened in Fountain Hills over the weekend with his address. It did feel like there was more of Kasich, a Cruz, and neither one of those was able to gain momentum.
Well, I think the problem that they have is they don't have a very good alternative that they like. Kasich has trailed so much in the polls and done so poorly that people feel that if they vote for him, that it may be a vote that's wasted. And all the noise around Donald Trump has obscured the fact that Ted Cruz is about the most hated man in Washington. There's not a friend to be found. A couple of people are finally going over to him just at horror at the thought that Trump would capture the Republican nomination. He's not a Republican Party stalwart. So they're sort of a problem they have about where do they have to go.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with political analyst, longtime pollster Mike O'Neill of O'Neill Associates. He's also host of the radio program The Think Tank. Mike, going specifically to voter behavior, where does this momentum from individual candidates come from? It reminds me a lot, I know you're not nearly as much of a sports fan as I am, but this idea that when teams start going on winning streaks, they get more fans. The Cardinals here in Phoenix were, a lot of people were sort of iffy. There were some really tight fans, but many, now there are a lot of bandwagon fans. You're seeing Cardinals license plates everywhere. Why does that seem to apply to political candidates as well?
I'm not so sure. I haven't seen a whole lot of evidence of bandwagon effects. I think when somebody like Trump takes hold, it's because, I mean, it's an interesting phenomenon. I mean, I think there's a whole nexus of things. We have at least one network that's been railing against the government for years, and there's divisive politics. He projects strength, which is always a positive thing. And I think the other thing is he's been the master of simple solution. We got a problem with immigration, build a wall. We got a problem with terrorists, just bomb the bejesus out of them. Just get a job. I think there's also a racial undertone to it. A lot of it, particularly to low information and less educated voters, and he does appeal more strongly to less educated voters. There's poll data on that, though interesting, not necessarily low-income voters. In other words, education predicts to a Trump vote. Income does not. And you put all of those things together in a situation with a lot of alienation that's a product of many factors, and I think you have a recipe for what's happened.
Mike, I guess, and obviously you know this better than I, but what strikes me is when I see the passion displayed by folks who are, whether at a Trump rally or something else, and it hits at the core of human behavior to me, which is why would, I mean, certainly one would like to be enthusiastic about a candidate and vote for whatever the viewpoint of this person is, or this person is going to bring a positive effect to the nation or my community, whatever it may be. But what is it that gets voters excited enough to cheer for some candidate throwing out platitudes or whatnot? Because based on the cynic in me, most politicians, based on either because they don't really mean what they say or because the system is such, they really can't do these things they're promising. So why do we still hoop and holler?
And it's interesting you mentioned, for example, they're not going to do the things. Half the Trump supporters don't believe he's going to actually build the wall.
Mm.
But what they're doing, he is speaking in a way, and you get some of the similar effect with Bernie Sanders. People are feeling that the way he's speaking of things resonates with their gut instinctive feelings. And when that happens, they're willing to discard facts. And emotion I'll take emotion over facts any day if you're trying to persuade people. All the research has always shown that. If you get people to resonate with what you believe, and you hear this often in political discourse, you see, well, I have the feeling he's given me the straight truth. Usually what that means is he's telling me what I want to hear.
So is it a feeling we want to believe this, even though in our heart of hearts, in the back of our minds, we don't necessarily believe it?
Well, I mean, to be specific, and the issue of immigration and the wall. I mean, I just said half the people don't think he's going to be able to build it. But the fact that he says we're going to sort of says that he understands for a lot of people what is in their gut. Do something. And you know, simple solutions have always had an appeal. And I mean, this is one of the downsides of our electoral process, because, you know, the problems that are left are not the simple ones, or somebody would have already done them. The problems that we have left are complicated and complex. But if you're really frustrated about something, you don't want to hear that. You want to hear, you just have to, you know, do X. And when you do X, that solves the problem. That resonates. Not somebody who says, you know, comes across like a college professor and says, well, it's really more complicated than that. They don't want to hear that if you're worked up.
How much of this for you comes down to the fact that many primary voters tend to be on the Republican side, the most conservative, Democratic side, most liberal? They're the most excited people about casting votes in a primary. Is that part of where we're seeing this passion from?
That is always the case in primaries, but I think this instance goes beyond that. Donald Trump is pulling a lot of people who were not Republicans. He's pulling from the independent side as well. And he's done a little bit better in states with open primaries, but we had a closed primary, and you saw how well he did here. That absolutely doesn't explain all of it, but I think it's more. I mean, Ted Cruz is as Ted Cruz, if you take it issue by issue, is way more conservative than Donald Trump. A lot of Donald Trump's positions have wavered, but Cruz has not been able to appeal to the instinctive gut feeling the way that Donald Trump has. So it's not just more extreme conservative voters, because if that's what it was, they'd be going to Ted Cruz.
Do you think there is a waning passion for politicians in general? Do you think that the impact Trump has had is going to change the cycle going forward?
Well, the word politician is a negative word. It connotes insincerity, and so that's the real trick of a good politician, is not to appear to be a politician.
So going forward, though, is Trump just this unique person, or are we going to see more people? Michael Bloomberg had made noise about perhaps getting in. Of course, he's really not associated with either party. Do you think we're going to see?
Yeah. And it's very hard to get worked up about centrist.
But do you think we're going to see those more ego-driven big businessmen in the future going forward saying, well, if Trump can do it, I can do it?
Well, I think, you know, I tend to doubt it because, for example, if he gets elected, I mean, if he's very successful, that's one thing. If it's a disaster, I think it might sort of pinch that balloon for a while. But, you know, it's not an unknown trait. People who have background in business have since, you know, way back have tried to cite that. Well, really since the beginning of this anti-government thing, which started around Ronald Reagan, 1980, the government, you know, the government is not your friend, it's the enemy. People have been running as I'm a businessman with phrases like I'm going to run government like a business. That has been a very appealing mantra for some time. In Trump's case, I think that's only part of it. It's his decisiveness, even the bluster, all the stuff all of us thought would sink him has proven to be assets. And that people who are angry, the more he sticks to even among more of his extreme statements, the more his supporters feel he's really talking to me.
Political analyst Mike O'Neill, he's also host of the radio program The Think Tank. Mike, thanks as always.
Anytime.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Earlier this year, the public found out about complaints made by 13 current and former employees at the Grand Canyon. They included supervisors and co-workers who pressured female workers for sex and retaliated when they were turned down or if the women reported the behavior. The Interior Department's Inspector General concluded there was a hostile work environment. With more detail on what's going on and the abuse females have faced in these situations, I'm joined by Catherine Joyce. She's a reporter with the Nation Institute's Investigative Fund. Her recent piece was featured at Huffington Post's Highline. Catherine, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Give us an overall perspective on this, because you write about the National Park Service and the U.S. Forest Service, including a lot of men who have wanted their jobs over the years to be seen through kind of a rugged lens. So how much of the harassment you write about has to do with men simply being uncomfortable with women trying to do their jobs?
I think that is a big part of it. For this story, I looked at what was happening in the Grand Canyon, similar to what the OIG looked at, and also what was happening in California's branch of the U.S. Forest Service, particularly looking at female firefighters working there in wildland fire. And both of these agencies, the National Park Service and the Forest Service, have these long traditions of being fairly hesitant to welcome women into their ranks. And this is going back 100 years or more in some cases. These are organizations that were founded on a sort of military model. In some cases, they were kind of an auxiliary branch of the military, formed by cavalrymen who were there to protect the wild lands from poaching and things like that. And in the years since, there's been a real reticence to make themselves fully open to female staff. The firefighters in California have seen this for about the last 30, 35 years. And now we've been seeing that it's also been an issue in the Grand Canyon for the last 10 or 15.
Did the men you talked to who've been accused of misbehavior seem apologetic, confused, or did they feel that things had been blown out of proportion?
I mean, in terms of the couple of men who would speak to me and answer questions, because some of the men who we wrote about would not agree to do that, some of them did not see their actions as sexual harassment. So in terms of things like asking women to sleep in the tent with them or snuggle or bathe with them naked, they claimed that they hadn't seen these as having any sexual content. In some cases, some of the men talked about how much they had brought to the job, their skills and expertise, and sort of downplayed the fact that they had been disciplined once or they had ended up leaving their jobs because of an issue of sexual harassment.
It does seem like there is a real disconnect there. This idea that's why I'm trying to figure out whether, is it clear that there is malice there? Do we have to say, well, these men are cut from a different cloth, or should we be universally offended?
I think in some cases, it was striking to me that some of the men seemed to not see behavior that most of the country, I think, would clearly recognize as sexual harassment or, in a few cases, assault, that they did not see those as offensive forms of behavior. However, kind of looking at the bigger picture, I think, you know, in some cases there have been acts of malice that I would say that's true. Some women ended up losing their jobs because of retaliation for filing sexual harassment claims. And it seemed that among some individuals, there was a real resentment that women had made these claims that had led to men being disciplined or losing their jobs. But then I think in the bigger picture, there's also a question of what was management supposed to be doing? And in many of these cases, women had been making reports of sexual harassment. They had, you know, gone up the chain just like they're supposed to when something had happened, when they had been improperly propositioned while they were working, when somebody had made them feel unsafe or had touched them inappropriately. And a lot of times, both in California and also at the Grand Canyon, it seemed that management did not do the right thing. They had downplayed the incidents. They had treated them with a kind of shocking lack of confidentiality in some cases, allowing complaints that women made, which are supposed to be treated very much with confidentiality, to make their way back down to the men who were accused, which set some of these women up for more retaliation. I think that is the more systemic issue that we have to look at is, you know, whether or not these men were bad apples or part of a larger picture, there is supposed to be a system in place that prevents this sort of thing from happening without repercussion.
And Catherine, can you briefly tell us the story of Lisa Donnelly? You write about Lisa, the class action suit she filed, and what she's doing now.
Sure. So Lisa Donnelly is a former Forest Service worker in Northern California. And back in 1994, she had already been working with the agency for about 15 years when she was in a position where she was being harassed by a number of her supervisors. She filed a lawsuit, and this mistaken word got out that she was actually filing a class action lawsuit on behalf of all California Forest Service women. So she began being inundated with calls from female firefighters in particular, but also all kinds of members, female members of the Forest Service, telling her these shocking stories, stories of women who had burning logs rolled at them while they were on a job, women who were maybe the only woman on their fire crew whose colleagues were joking about raping them in their sleep, or, you know, doing things defacing posters with obscene language referring to an equal employment opportunity mandate in the state. So she started hearing all of these stories and realized there was a much bigger problem out there, and she filed a class action lawsuit, in fact, in 1995, that ended up focusing on retaliation against women who had joined the service or backlash against women who were kind of trying to diversify the ranks of the Forest Service. And that was in effect for 10 years, but she says she's become an advocate since then, and she works with hundreds of women, particularly in California's Forest Service, but she also ended up working with some of the women at the Grand Canyon, and she says that in both these agencies, as well as in other wilderness backcountry jobs, these issues are still going on, that these are fields that are still very resistant to being fully open to women.
Catherine, finally, in our last minute or so, are there strong efforts to change the atmosphere, apply new rules, hire different kinds of people?
I think that, That sort of remains to be seen. The DOI's Inspector General, as you mentioned, they released a significant report that found really strong indications of a widespread culture of harassment and hostile workplace at the Grand Canyon. And in response to that, in February, the Grand Canyon, the Park Service of the Grand Canyon, and also the larger regional level, wrote a response detailing some of the things that they want to do in response to that report. That included some personnel changes, possible repercussions for managers who mishandled things, as well as some policy changes. I think for a lot of people who were involved in this complaint, there's a sense of, you know, let's wait and see whether or not they actually follow through on any of these, because the same sorts of complaints have been being made for about 35 years in California. And Lisa Donnelly, the advocate I just mentioned, has said that, you know, despite multiple class action lawsuits, there have been four so far, we're still not seeing the change that needs to happen.
Catherine Joyce is a reporter with the Nation Institute's Investigative Fund. We've been talking about her piece, Out Here, No One Can Hear You Scream. Catherine, thank you for the time.
Thank you so much.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll hear about the never-open desert diner, and we'll hear the music of Roy Orbison. Stay with us.
KJZZ is supported by Doc Trials, now conducting clinical trials at Arizona Eye Center with Dr. Michael Deppenbush for those needing cataract surgery. Participation information is online at doctrials.com.
Good morning. It's KJZZ's Here and Now at 91.5, KJZZ.org, and on our mobile app. Well, here's what's going on in Valley traffic right now. I-10 westbound near 32nd Street. The right lanes are blocked. That's causing a backup all the way through the Broadway curve. On the surface streets in Tempe, there's a crash at Hardy and Southern. Also 92nd Street and Via Linda in Scottsdale. Here and Now from Boston starts at 12. We'll hear from a British member of the European Parliament who says his fellow Muslims must help fight terrorism by helping to prevent young Muslims from becoming radicalized. We're looking for sunshine today in the valley, high near 77 degrees. It'll be 81 tomorrow. Mostly sunny and 67 degrees right now in Phoenix at 11:43.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Those of us who've lived in the desert for any amount of time understand it can be a different sort of place, to say the least, and that's part of the reason it makes such a good setting for suspenseful fiction. And James Anderson uses isolated areas of Utah's deserts as a character of sorts in his novel, The Never-Open Desert Diner. Anderson will be at Changing Hands Bookstore in Phoenix tomorrow night at 7, and he joins me now. James, thanks for being with us.
Steve, great to be with you.
So as I mentioned in introducing you, the desert is such a strong character and people have such responses to it, such strong responses, positive and negative. How big a role does the desert play in your novel?
Oh, it's huge. It's huge. I've always been fascinated by that intersection between humanity and landscape. And the desert itself operates in high relief because the things that really matter in life come into focus in the desert.
And as part of that, in the novel, there's kind of an intensity that I think, for some readers, it's going to draw readers in, but it can also be a little uncomfortable. How does that impact you as a writer when you're writing those kinds of scenes or chapters?
That is a very good question, Steve. Well, I think discomfort is good in a way. It makes it difficult. You want to be very careful about accuracy, especially emotional accuracy. So those sections, I think you spend a lot of time with, and you think about it, and after you write them over and over, and you edit them and revise them, if you're still uncomfortable, then you're doing your job.
You know, this isn't a formulaic novel, to say the least. And when you're writing something like this, how thought-provoking do you want it to be? We talked about discomfort. Do you want readers to leave the book with some questions about how they might react in a certain situation, or do you want to leave them with semi-clean answers?
No, I don't want semi-clean answers. I don't want irrevocably clean answers. I think that the best works of of literature are a point of departure. And if you tie everything up neatly in a bow, there's nothing to do after you close the book. And one of the things that I've been very pleased about with all the reviews is how often reviewers will say, this book just stayed with me after I finished the last page. Mm.
You know, I think about some of the characters, let's say maybe Ben Jones comes to mind. I don't know if I should label him an anti-hero. Maybe that's not fair, but it does feel like we're seeing more in fiction the emergence of the anti-hero, at least the complicated protagonist. How complex is Ben as a character for you?
Well, you know, I don't really see him as being particularly complex, any more so than anyone else. We're all grappling with issues of life, and some our responses are compassionate and open, and in other situations, we don't handle them so well. Ben's trying to be a better person. He wants to be a better person, but he's if you'll excuse me, I want to bring in another character, but he's sort of like Preacher John, who hauls that long cross. Ben has his own crosses he's carrying, as we all do.
So then how much of the novel is plot-driven, how much is character-driven, and do you think those can work comfortably in sync?
Oh, boy. Gee, Steve, these are great questions. And they're tough to answer. The thing about the Never Open Desert Diner is it's not formulaic. If you're looking for something that's solely plot driven, it's not. It is a character study, and there is a very strong plot, but it comes about organically, I guess I'd like to say. I hope that's not too much of a cop out, but it isn't one of those things where in every paragraph it's some damn new thing popping up. Ben, you kind of follow Ben out in the desert as he makes his deliveries to these desert exiles. As one person said, I enjoy reading about these people, but I don't think I'd like to meet them. So I think that's a good thing, but it's all of those things, you know. It's a romance, it's a mystery, it's a meditation on place, it's a character study, it is a mystery. It's all those things, and given what page you're on, kind of determines what it is at that moment.
James Anderson is a novelist. The name of his book is The Never Open Desert Diner. He'll be at Changing Hands Bookstore in Phoenix tomorrow night at 7. James, thanks for the conversation.
Thank you very much, Steve.
Singer Roy Orbison's work and his voice are often described as haunting and sad. Songs like Oh Pretty Woman and Only the Lonely are anything but upbeat, and since Orbison wrote or co-wrote many of his tunes, it's assumed that their downbeat nature came from a tough early life. That's one of the topics explored in the documentary Roy Orbison, One of the Lonely Ones. The film is making its U.S. premiere 1 week from tonight at 7 p.m. at Tempe Marketplace. It's being hosted by the Arizona Humanities Council and the ASU Center for Film, Media, and Popular Culture. The center's director is Peter Lehman, a Roy Orbison scholar. Peter, what has made the Orbison songs so identifiable?
One of the things that he did was to abandon the common verse, chorus, bridge structure in pop music so popular at that time, so that many of his songs, like Running Scared, crying in dreams. They don't repeat anything. They go in totally unexpected directions. They don't even copy each other. Every one of them, none of them conform to the verse chorus bridge structure, and none of them actually conform to copying the previous hit. So they have rather complex structures. The other characteristic that I think people remember, the unique qualities of his voice that combined an unusual vocal register that was, there were people that were singing falsettos, but they didn't have the rich quality that his voice could retain across an incredible vocal range.
Now, there's a haunting nature to his voice. There's a haunting nature to the songs, too, and you talk about writing them. Did that come from a real place? Was he someone who had a rough childhood, a rough background?
There's frequently a confusion about the relationship of Roy Orbison's life to his music. He himself felt there was a connection between the place and the childhood and the music, but it's not the connection that the public makes. For him, it was growing up in West Texas, which he felt was a kind of isolated, despairing kind of environment, which was conducive to loneliness. But in the public's mind, the relationship between his songs and his personal life was that his personal life was thought of as being horribly tragic with the death of his first wife, Claudette, in a motorcycle accident while he was riding alongside her. A couple of years later, the death of two of his three children in a fire in his home when he was actually off on a tour traveling at the time. But what is wrong with that chronology is he had written all the songs we just talked about, from Only the Lonely in 1960 to Oh Pretty Woman in 1964, all were written, and his persona, including the dark glasses and the jet black hair that would come to define his dark persona that he had in the public's imagination, all of that preceded any of the so-called tragedies in his real life. So if there's a relationship, it's not what the public thinks. It's not that he had terrible tragedies and therefore he wrote these dark songs about tragedy and loneliness, but that in some bizarre way, his life almost came to mirror his songs rather than the songs somehow mirroring what had happened to him in his life.
Know the way I feel tonight. This feeling ain't right. There goes my baby. There goes my heart. They're gone forever. So far apart. But only the
maybe it's because the oldies radio stations really started to take off, let's say, in the late 70s and into the 80s. But it feels like Roy Orbison's work never really went away. But that's really not the case, is it? I mean, was it in the late 60s and the 70s, were they listening to Roy Orbison? Did he attract an audience?
He became so obscure in the late 60s and the 70s. There was a period of time between 68 and 71 when I was living in New York City. And I would go into Manhattan to try to get his most recent album in Manhattan. And I would go from record store to record store. At that time, I still remember it was like Sam Goody's was the big, big record store. And I would walk in and the people would look at me like, who? And I mean, he had fallen so, and people would say things like, is he still alive? And it was unbelievable the reactions you would get. And that was just between 4 and 7 years after that monster hit, Oh Pretty Woman. Roy Orbison was not ever really discovered by critics. They never appreciated his accomplishments. It was a combination of other musicians and filmmakers. There were so many of the most popular musicians in later generations that had such, that considered him like the greatest influence on their work, that I think the critics kind of eventually came around by saying, gee, we must have overlooked something here, because every musician and every filmmaker practically of any accomplishment is carrying on about Roy Orbison. So I think it was an unusual pattern of his kind of being rediscovered.
Well, how did his work with the Traveling Wilburys fit into that?
That was part of a very important period. There were about three things going on at the same time around then, from around 1980 to the period near the very end of his life. He died in 1988. The first thing that happened in the 80s is that Bruce Springsteen, who at that point in time was about as popular as anyone in the world of rock and roll, inducted him into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in what became a very, very important speech. And he talked about how important Roy's music was for him. And that was around the time that David Lynch used In Dreams in Blue Velvet. And that was one of the most distinctive uses of a rock and roll or popular music song in all in the history, to this day, I think, in the history of movies. And so he re-recorded all his hits in the mid-80s. That ended up being, when he signed a new recording contract with Virgin Records, the first thing they did is reissue all those re-recordings, plus the new, he did a new version of In Dreams. That brought his catalog back into the mainstream where people could listen to. So a lot of them actually became aware of his music around that period of time with that re-recording and the use of In Dreams in Blue Velvet. And then the Traveling Wilburys came along shortly after that.
What is his continued legacy? Has music changed so dramatically that new musicians aren't listening to Roy Orbison, or is he coming up in unexpected ways even today?
I think it's both the things that you're talking about. It almost defies understanding how he constantly stays at the forefront and keeps getting rediscovered. The critical awareness seems to be growing. When the MGM box set was released just this past November, the reviewer for American Songwriter starts out with in the first paragraph by saying, "There's consensus among all people knowledgeable about music that Roy Orbison is one of the 10 greatest singers in the history of American music. Many would say that he's the greatest of all time." And that kind of response was like so unimaginable. Just a few years before he died, no one knew who he was. Many major films have used his music. The most recent is Quentin Tarantino in Hateful Eight. There's one song used in that movie.
Okay.
And it was till now a very obscure Roy Orbison song called "There Won't Be Many Coming Home." Quentin Tarantino uses it in its entirety, beginning exactly when it says "written and directed by Quentin Tarantino" is when the song starts, and it plays entirely through the end credits.
Peter Lehman is director of the ASU Center for Film, Media, and Popular Culture. We've been talking about the film coming up next Wednesday night at 7 at Tempe Marketplace. It's the U.S. premiere of the documentary Roy Orbison, One of the Lonely Ones. Peter, nice to meet you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
And that's all for today's edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. Thanks to senior producer Sarah Ventry and Bruce Drummond for their assistance on the program. And thank you very much for listening. If you want to hear my conversations with Mike O'Neill about voter behavior, Catherine Joyce about harassment at the Grand Canyon, and Peter Lehman about Roy Orbison, or one of our previous programs, please go online to kjzz.org later this afternoon, or you can download the free KJZZ app to your smartphone. This is member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Steve Goldstein. Have a great rest of the day. It's 12 o'clock.
KJZZ is supported by Scottsdale Center for the Performing Arts. Taps, Tunes, and Tall Tales. Broadway legend Tommy Tune shares songs and stories from his 50 years in showbiz. Saturday, April 2nd, ScottsdalePerformingArts.org.